The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you to another edition of the Russian Orthodox Medievalists. I want to thank all of my regular listeners. I've heard that I've gotten some good comments. I normally don't check blogs and things like that, but I appreciate legitimate criticism and of course affirmation of what we do here. And what we do here primarily is to deepen our knowledge of Russia and its culture and history and religion with the vision and with the understanding that the Russian-led alliance, which now includes Armenia, China, Iran, and Kazakhstan, this alliance is aimed at the New World Order, that Russia is one of its primary players, and Russia is now leading this counter-alliance to the American-Israeli war machine. And that's, you know, I mean, there's ideological differences, there are political differences, or religious differences, but suffice it to say that the Russian counter-alliance is largely one based on nationalism, one based on regionalism, one based on a strong state for the sake of self-defense, while on the other hand, the American-led alliance is based on liberalism, is based on buccaneer capitalism, and quite frankly, is based on oligarchy. And this is why, I mean, at the most basic level, this is why the American ruling class, both neoconservative and neoliberal, openly supported the Russian oligarchs against Vladimir Putin. The fact is that whether it be Ariel Cohen at the Heritage Foundation, or John McCain, or Bill Clinton, or any of these other people, regardless of their background, the American dominant oligarchical interests saw a kindred spirit in Russia itself. And they came to the defense of oligarchy. They came to the defense of the domination of labor of the Russian people, the Ukrainian people, in the hands of a handful of oligarchs, the vast majority of whom were also citizens of Israel. And so the American ruling class, and we, you know, this is purely foundational here, but we need to know that the American ruling class in the Russian case openly came out for an oligarchical constitution. They did it strictly in a Russian context. They may not have the safety, the confidence to say it in an American context. But in the Russian context, both neoconservatives and neoliberals came out with the concept that the oligarchy should rule, it has a right to rule, and this is, believe it or not, I mean, this is what the American ruling class openly calls democracy. So, certainly, if that's the definition of democracy, then I, in this show, are extremely anti-democratic. We are nationalists. We believe in ethnicity. We believe in tradition. We believe in the life of the land. We believe in a life of simplicity and religious devotion. And these things don't fall from the sky. These cultural things, and I've been saying this and writing this for almost 20 years now, that these structures, the ethnic tradition, national tradition, these structures derive from suffering. They derive from the growth and development of the nation itself, long before there was ever any kind of centralized state to dominate them. And that's what ethnicity really is. They are structures of survival, the structures of survival. These are the methods, these are the ideas lived by the common people that brought the common people out of suffering. This is why they're valuable. You know, and this is why, as far as the Western American ruling class is concerned, these cultural buttresses have to be destroyed, because these cultural buttresses are the primary rationale and background for revolt. It is not abstract ideology. The leftist Marxist and anarchist views, these are pseudo-radical. They are largely supported by the ruling classes. And grant money is often given to their scholars and writers. That's pseudo rebellion. The real rebellion is the ethnic local tradition. An ethnic local tradition which itself is the product of suffering. It's the product of what the people have gone through, and these structures are the means whereby the people have gotten through this kind of suffering. And that's why the ethnic principle is so important. It's a moral principle. It is a moral idea. So in this show, we deal primarily with these structures as they concern Russia and Ukraine, and specifically the Orthodox Church, which is the moral and spiritual bond between them. And given that, today we are going to deal a little bit with literature. And today we are going to deal some general concepts and some more specific ideas in the thought of Fyodor Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky is somebody not greatly understood in the West, largely because in order to read Dostoevsky or a Gogol or Chekhov or any of these people, you have to have a solid grounding in not only Russian history, in the history of the Slavic peoples, but you also have to have a good working knowledge of the Orthodox life and Orthodox theology. Normally, university professors in literature who are incompetent on so many levels, even when they want to focus on Russian stuff, they often don't have the background in Russian history, Russian ideological movements, social movements, political movements, not to mention the theology and the development of the Orthodox idea as it's developed over the last 1,000 years, in order to properly evaluate and understand very complex writers like Gogol or Dostoevsky. Now, I happen to prefer Gogol to Dostoevsky, but there's no doubt that the two of them put Russia on the map as far as literature is concerned. Of course, Pushkin is another one. But today we're going to deal with Dostoevsky and really some of the more basic approaches that you can take in reading his material. We're going to deal with some general ideas first, and then if we have time, we're going to get into a few issues in The House of the Dead and my favorite novel from Dostoevsky, The Idiot, which is only rarely read in the West anymore, and that's a terrible shame. Let's say this. Let's start off by saying that Dostoevsky's primary reason for writing, his whole focus, is that there are two forces fighting for control and the devotion of the human heart and the human mind. That exists in politics, it exists in morality, it exists in theology, but it also exists in psychology. It exists within every person. And that is the devotion to the Son of God, on the one hand. The idea that through struggle and through self-limitation, through the ascetic life, one can reach divine status. Man becoming God. And man becomes God only because God himself has become man. The other side is exactly the opposite. The other side is the rule of Prometheus or Lucifer, essentially one and the same being. The being that promises that through some purely material mechanism, either through ideology or through scientific technique, or through something like this, man, through his own power, can become God. So it's the deification of individuals based on two very different principles. Those two different principles are the basis of the schism not just in Russian life, which is, you know, Dostoevsky's whole thing from a regional point of view, but also in every human soul, no matter when they lived or where they lived. The struggle between man seeking to extend and expand himself to dominate nature and as such to become God, or on the other hand, the simple ascetic approach, the concept of self-limitation to allow God to fill the believer and to bring him to divine status that way. The whole concept of man becoming divine through the influx of God, this is the central concept of orthodoxy. Wherever you find it, in Greece, in Russia, in Ukraine, this is the idea, and it's very different from the Western confessions. For this reason, it's a process of experiencing the transfiguration through the energies of the Holy Spirit from or to each believer. It's not this series of legalistic rules that you find, for example, in most Counter-Reformation Roman Catholicism. So even that very basic distinction is often lost on commentators on Dostoevsky, and they don't realize that this is really the nature of this schism that Dostoevsky is dealing with and go through everything that the man has ever written. Now, Prometheus, Lucifer, you know, I'm deliberately not using the word Satan here. Satan is a title. Antichrist is a title. In Dostoevsky's corpus, and really in the Orthodox mind, Prometheus slash Lucifer, this is a sort of mentality. This is the mentality of the Freemasonic lodges. This is the mentality of Friedrich Nietzsche. This is the idea that the Promethean idea is that, particularly the way Dostoevsky uses it, you see this in Gogol as well, the idea is that once an objective truth and falsehood, i.e. those things that exist outside of the human person as true, rather than being created by people, that exist outside of people and are discovered, if that objective understanding of truth and falsehood is eliminated, then all that remains is power. That's why Nietzsche is, in his own way, absolutely correct. Nietzsche and the existentialists who he helped form, and Nietzsche, by the way, because of Dostoevsky's particular interest in this, Nietzsche says that the only man that ever taught me anything about psychology was Dostoevsky. And it's odd because Dostoevsky vehemently opposed this whole concept of the will to power that Nietzsche was to make very famous. But Nietzsche and Dostoevsky were both honest enough to realize that when objectivity is eliminated, when absolute standards are eliminated, the only thing that remains is power.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Dostoevsky holds that atheism is not scientific, it is a metaphysical approach to the world. That the Promethean mentality, the Luciferian mentality, so central at least to the upper degrees of Freemasonry, needs the Trinity, needs God to fight. That the Luciferian mentality only functions if God exists. And then the Luciferian mentality then drapes itself as negation. And it's not an accident that this comes up in Dostoevsky's The Possessed, where the entire nihilistic movement doesn't exist in that they believe in nothing. That's not what nihilism means. Nihilism means that everything that exists, and of course we're talking about Russia, 1860s, 1870s, needs to be destroyed so that the will to power can come and dominate. Now, they never exactly say what it is they're going to build. They normally do approach the world as a matter of negation, but both in Nietzsche's case and the nihilists that came after him, the fact is that the will to power was primarily negation, but it was negation with the understanding that something else is going to be built. Now, there are people in characters in Dostoevsky's novels, again, I'm thinking of Stavrogin in The Possessed, where God cannot be known. And one of the ways that this is the case is that the structure of their mind exists in such a way that the concept of this kind of external reality, not necessarily just God as the absolute, but also anything that can be picked up by the senses, is in fact non-existent. That means all external stimuli can be reduced to inner psychic states. And Dostoevsky, you know, I mean, there's this problem where someone is asked to give a proof of God's existence, and then the retort is, I'll prove the existence of God if you prove the existence of matter. And of course, matter cannot be proven. Nothing in observation can be proven. All we know is that our senses provide not a report of external reality, but simply tell us about our current psychic state. The fact that we have a psychic state, we know at any given moment. But that this psychic state is occasioned by the existence of external objects, that is another matter. From a logical point of view, it cannot be proven. It has to be taken on faith. But that's a problem in and of itself. You see, ultimately, in Dostoevsky's corpus, and I'm thinking particularly here of The Possessed as well as Crime and Punishment, the idea is that not only is power your result if you remove objective standards, but more than this, if you remove objective standards and then reduce what we think are our senses, our sense data, to psychic states, then the absolute content of life is eliminated. What the individual will faces is the void. Ultimately, this is the problem that runs through all of Dostoevsky's corpus. It is very rare to find somebody who can confront the void. Nietzsche is one of these people. Nietzsche was able to say that the structure of reality is non-existent. Reality is something that is imposed on the herd by the dominant will. This is central to Nietzsche. It comes up in most of the corpus of Dostoevsky and has to be taken very seriously. But Nietzsche knew that only a handful of people had that capability. Dostoevsky knows that only a handful of people have that capability or are even able to ask the question about the void, never mind actually coming up with an answer to it. The average human being, Dostoevsky says, cannot rest with the understanding that his life is meaningless. They are not satisfied, intellectually or any other way, with the idea that his life is meaningless. He is born for no purpose, he lives and suffers for no purpose, he dies for no purpose, and goes back into the void. That is not a from Dostoevsky's view, Gogol's view, most of Russian literature, in fact, in the 19th century, that is not an acceptable understanding. So the average person then seeks to find salvation in something else. Usually, and particularly in The Possessed, you see it to some extent in The Brothers Karamazov, you see it a few other places, that ideology, political ideology, scientific theories, these come to fill the void. But even there, these are very unstable. And the real subtext of The Possessed is this idea that ideology is never a substitute for reality. Ideology is never a substitute for a true purpose in life, a purpose that existed prior to your birth, during your birth, and will continue to exist after your birth. Because even if I was to put my faith in scientific technique or in political ideology or some moral theory or some hard and fast ideological doctrine, I realize that, number one, these things are created by men. And number two, because of that, these things are always changing. New paradigms are coming in, old paradigms are going out, and it's impossible to tell what exists from personal self-interest, what exists from the powerful, and what is really true. So even these ways of trying to deal with the meaninglessness of existence, these things are never satisfying. And this is why early on Dostoevsky is called, along with Nietzsche, as one of your first existentialists. In other words, views that people hold are not held by them because they have logically deduced them from absolute principles. Views are not held by people because this is what is absolutely true. Views are held by people instrumentally. They're held by people because it helps them deal with life. They have a particular self-interest is being served by holding these views. It's very rarely, if ever, a rational approach to reality, whatever that happens to be. There is no absolute axiomatic principle that we can deduce something from. It simply doesn't exist. Dostoevsky is particularly sensitive to that point. Therefore, he's going to hold, basically, that these views, scientific, ideological, moral, whatever, these views are essentially arbitrary. That these views are held by people on the basis of self-interest, or it makes them sound smart, or it makes them sound sophisticated, or this is how they were brought up, or this is what makes them feel good. And you notice that if that's the case, then people really are wicked, and people really are fraudulent all the way down, as deep as it can go, because you know, they're basing their views purely on something that allows them to deal with life, and more specifically, allows them to deal with the void that all human beings face. This is central to Nietzsche, Dostoevsky, existentialism as a matter of course. So, Dostoevsky will hold up to his readers this concept that you either pick that which is unchanging, whether it be God or the forms of Plato. And of course, you know, many, many Orthodox people are heavily influenced by Plato. I'm very much a Platonist. I think Plato and Plotinus and the Neoplatonic movement in that era, is a very satisfying approach. But you either have this objective reality that exists in a transcendent form. It exists outside of our moods or our interests or the society that we live in, or we approach the void. Now, Dostoevsky also holds up somebody like the father who was eventually murdered in The Brothers Karamazov, this kind of debauched, you know, a sexual addict, an alcoholic, whatever, as really another way of dealing with the fact that all human beings have to make that choice. Ideology, alcohol, medication, we would say today, all of this stuff is a way of, a very weak way, as it turns out, of dealing with the choice that, the way Dostoevsky puts it, it is either God or it is the void. The fact is that Dostoevsky is convinced that most people solve the problem by never asking the question and condemning anyone who actually does ask the question. And this is nothing unique to Dostoevsky. This is a huge part of the Western philosophical heritage. Socrates asked this question. St. Augustine asked this question. The great theologians of the patristic period asked this question. And something that Socrates realized, and you see it from the Apology straight up to the end of his career, that if you deny the existence of transcendent absolute reality, the only thing that you are left with is eternal flux, the void, and the will to power. That means that whoever has power, who's able, ever capable of reaching to power, who is capable of dominating you, has the right to do it. And they have the right to do it because there is no place for you to stand. If you deny transcendent new reality, you deny the ability to transcend space and time and criticize societies and peoples and their actions from that point of view. Without God, without the absolute, you have the flux, you have the void. Ultimately, that void is filled with power. It is filled with whoever it is that's powerful enough to dominate society, to control ideology, what people believe, what shows up in the media, what is considered mainstream, and what is expelled to the outer darkness of extremity. And that's all that's all that remains. Science always changes. Ideology always changes. Fashion always changes. And so people deal with that through irrational behavior. This is something that comes up over and over again in Dostoevsky's corpus.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
One of the great examples of this approach, the approach of the choice that people make, we could find in somebody who's been dealt with a lot, of course, Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment. Raskolnikov is somebody who approaches this question of the void by adopting the Nietzschean point of view. He reasons this way. Now, he's going to turn out to be a killer, and that's really at the very beginning of the novel and makes sense of the story as a whole. Here's the deal. As far as Crime and Punishment goes, we could simplify it this way. Raskolnikov approaches the void. He realizes that there's a void there. He's got to fill it somehow. Clearly, he is a Nietzschean of one kind or another. He says to himself, I read in my history books that some of the great heroes of our civilization have been responsible for the death of thousands, if not millions, of people. I read about all the great monarchs of Russian history. I read about Napoleon. I read about the American revolutionaries. I read about the British Civil War. And you have heroes and villains, and the heroes, as it turns out, under all kinds of circumstances, even in the Old Testament of the Bible, have killed large numbers of people, sometimes lots and lots of innocent people. So I tell you what I'm going to do. I am going to kill a woman who I know, an old lady that everybody hates, who takes advantage of the poor. She's a pawnbroker. She takes advantage of poor people. She's a usurer. She charges a lot of interest on her money. Everyone hates her. So if my understanding of history is consistent, when I kill her, I'm in fact not only committing a moral act, but I should be a hero. If Napoleon is someone to admire, who is responsible for killing God knows how many innocent people, not to mention combatants, then how much more wonderful am I going to be if I kill one miserable, disgusting pawnbroker? You figure, well, you know, at first glance, when I lectured on this at the university, students really didn't know what to say to this. Those who were actually paying attention began to squirm a little bit. How do you answer that? How do you answer this? That, you know, we're eliminating somebody who, by any moral standard, is a disgusting human being. Well, this is exactly what he does. He axes her to death. Now, unfortunately for him, a young woman walks in, witnesses this crime, and so he's got to eliminate her too. But, you know, this is, it's something that I had to do with, you know, I got to get away with this. Everyone lives with this slave morality. What am I going to do? But from that moment on, something happens. Raskolnikov is slowly going to go insane. And there's a whole lot of detail here, which we're not going to deal with. But suffice it to say that this crime that he commits is sort of the Nietzschean approach to the fact that, at least in his mind, the only thing that exists is the void, the eternal flux of matter, which really is one and the same thing. And if that's true, then the only thing that exists is power. Now here's the deal. The name of this character is Raskolnikov. Raskol in Russia means schism. It means a split. The axe in Russian history that he uses to kill the old pawnbroker, the axe is an old symbol of double-mindedness, of a living a lie. It cuts both ways. It's very useful for civilization, but it's also very destructive. And in fact, all elements of civilization, to the extent that they derive from power relations, are as evil as they are good. And ultimately, throughout Dostoevsky's Corpus, it is the simplicity. The hero, the heroine in Sonya, in Crime and Punishment, Prince Mishkin in The Idiot, these are never learned people. These people somehow either exist outside of civilization in one sense or another, or exist apart from civilization to one extent or another. Dostoevsky will always have a very ambiguous approach to the institutions of civilization. Not just modern civilization, but civilization in general. Because every institution that has come to build up civilization of whatever type is useful, and that it produces certain things that we can use or that we want, but is also the result of power. It always privileges some people over others. It's an attempt to control nature. It is something in the Russian mind that, when you read Pushkin's The Bronze Horseman, for example, it's something that goes back to Peter the Great, the man who sought to build the greatest city in Europe on the most inhospitable swamps of northwestern Russia. And it was a Masonic experiment. It was a Masonic experiment in that civilization can dominate, control, and manipulate matter in the interests of the initiated. If Peter was initiated, he was a Freemason. He was initiated in Amsterdam into a lodge on his grand embassy, and that's related In Robert Massey's book, the very humongous biography of Peter the Great, it's actually a mainstream work you could get anywhere, where it does hold that the Petersburg idea is an experiment. It is a explicit Promethean approach to nature. This is not lost on Dostoevsky. The axe that Raskolnikov is going to use to kill is the axe of the Petrine state. It is the way that, you know, trees can be felled to begin building homes and civilization in general, but that axe can also kill you. We might look at civilization, we might look at all the benefits that we gain from it, but oftentimes we don't notice that the artifacts of civilization have been responsible for the deaths of hundreds of millions of people, whether it be, you know, in weaponry, in wars over territory or money, wars over greed, wars over pride, all of these deriving from the institutions of advanced civilization. There is always, civilization itself is a double-edged sword. It's an axe. It's an axe with two blades, one behind and one before. This is essential to understanding Dostoevsky, specifically Crime and Punishment, but it comes up again and again and again. It has a whole lot of different metaphors that are used. But it's something essential to Dostoevsky's approach to the world. You see it again in a character that has a lot written on him, some of it worthwhile, a lot of it is in my cat's litter box right about now. Ivan Karamazov and the Brothers Karamazov, you see a very similar thing. In both cases, you have a person split in two. In Crime and Punishment, Raskolnikov will eventually turn himself in and deliberately go to Siberia. He's doing this because, I mean, he could have gotten away with it. He eventually couldn't, there was another side to him. A side to him that was in contact with the transcendent. He had been suppressing it. It's a split, not just in Russian civilization, in civilization, but in every person. What will drive him crazy is that he can't keep up the act forever. He realizes that he has transgressed something that no man, including Napoleon, has a right to transgress. That side of him, not that exists in imperial, empirical nature, but the side of him that exists in the transcendent world began to torment him and to drive him crazy. This is more than conscience. This is way more than, we're not talking about conscience here. We're talking about a completely different element in the human person. We're talking about the soul in the Christian sense as well as in Plato's sense. This entity of the human person that alone can have some contact with the absolute truth of the world that exists and can only exist in transcendence. You see it in Raskolnikov. This is why he will eventually turn himself in. He will turn himself in because he knows that he deserves punishment, that there are objective laws that exist outside of space and time. In other words, it doesn't matter whether or not a government accepts it or not. It doesn't matter whether or not you're caught. You know you are guilty in both. And you see this in Plato, and you see it in Dostoevsky. The concept in the specific work of Plato is the Gorgias, which is definitely worth your time. Punishment is a very good thing. Plato argues that it's better for a criminal to be caught and punished than for the criminal, even if he never commits another crime again, to get away with it, because the punishment will restore the balance to the person. Speaking very simply, it will restore the balance of the person. Punishment is a good thing because it is restorative. It restores that balance. The balance between the empirical world that we live in, like it or not, and that world that we often shut out, that world of transcendent reality, that is to say, that reality outside of space and time. This is very common. This is a common concept in Western philosophy, and Dostoevsky believes that these experiences can't really be put in the expository prose of the philosopher. It has to be stated in really sort of the day-to-day empirical approach to the world that you find in literature.
Don't go away, because there's more on The Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to The Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Here is the same schism, the same split in Ivan Karamazov, one of the Karamazov brothers made famous by the book. Now, here's a man who is struggling with this very same schism, but it's stated here a little differently. On the one hand, you have the concept that if God does not exist, or putting it differently, if transcendent reality does not exist, then all things are possible. If God does exist, if transcendent reality does exist, then I must accept the reality of innocent suffering. And this comes up quite often. Ivan is tortured by this schism. Innocent suffering is an issue when transcendent reality exists, because this transcendent reality is by its very definition changeless and therefore perfect. If X is true, then X must never change. Absolutely central to Plato, to St. Augustine, to Christianity, to Dostoevsky. You see it in that very, very straight line. Now, you know, these two schisms, in Ivan's case, it's highly problematic. At the very least, Raskolnikov will turn himself in and go off to Siberia, and he's happy to go off to Siberia because there he will be able to pay the price. In both cases, Crime and Punishment and the brothers Karamazov, those two characters are tortured by this very same schism. It's put differently, that, you know, there exists a realm of perfection and a will, that is God, who, in a personality, who is in control of it. And if that's the case, in Raskolnikov's case, if that's true, then I must turn myself in because I am objectively guilty. If I am objectively guilty, then I must be punished whether I want to be or not. Plato would say that the truly moral man wants to be punished for the restoration of balance, the restoration of the natural law. On the other hand, Ivan Karamazov puts it in a way that if God does not exist, I could do whatever I please. But I don't want to believe that God exists, because if that's true, then I need to suffer with the fact that God has permitted the existence of innocent suffering. It's really the same concept, just putting it in two different ways. This battle really typifies the character of Ivan Karamazov, and what it comes down to is the following. No man, under any circumstances, can violate absolute value. If he does this, he will be tortured as a result of it, regardless of how it all turns out, whether it be suicide, whether it be fanatical ideology, or whether it be conversion, or whatever it is. When absolute value, when that line is transgressed, the result is pain, agony, and torture. Dostoevsky's corpus is based around the idea that without a superior idea to self-interest in life, life is a mockery, life is a joke, and is not worth living when there's no purpose in it. That Dostoevsky holds throughout all of his views, whatever he happens to be writing on, that true self, that self that typifies the individual that is in contact with transcendent reality, that self, that person, is distinguishable from the empirical person that you see wandering around. This is the common idea. Evil in Dostoevsky is ultimately the expansion of the ego over not only other people, but also over that part of the soul that is in contact with eternal life, the forms of Plato. And, you know, what St. Augustine does, of course, is take the forms of Plato as absolute, unchanging, spiritual truth, spiritual in the sense that they are not based on matter and they are not reducible to matter, in the mind of God. And it's certainly acceptable, both logically and metaphysically, for Augustine to do that, and became a very important concept in the Greek church. But it's not, and this is why Dostoevsky had a problem with Peter the Great. Even Pushkin had a problem with Peter the Great, because Peter was viewed as that man who made a principle of transgressing that line, that the ego, the empirical ego, that's trapped in this world for the time being, believes itself capable and having the right to transgress either other egos, nature, God, transcendent form. Over and over again, every single solitary one of Dostoevsky's major novels is dealing with this particular idea. Individuals in this existential situation, in a situation where they are faced with this choice, a choice that they don't know how to deal with, the choice of God on the one hand and the void on the other, and all the implications. Like Ivan is suffering with the implications. If God doesn't exist, all is possible, but ultimately all is meaningless. On the other hand, if God does exist, I got this problem with innocent suffering. What people like Ivan try to do, and a lot of the negative characters in Dostoevsky's novels, what they all try to do is find completion in a world that, at least in its empirical aspect, the aspect of the things that we could see and touch and experience, cannot provide us with completion. The concept of completion can only be provided by that which is in itself complete, that has fully actualized all of its potential, that is unchanging and that is spiritual, that is not based on the self-interest of people or governments or economics or anything else, and that is the transcendent. The central core of Dostoevsky is this idea that everything is seeking completion exactly where it shouldn't be. You can't seek completion and purpose in the world of nature where it is not complete. It is continuously developing and it's always changing. Completion cannot be found there. That which is beyond and above the ever-changing, this world of cause and effect, ultimately reduced by both Nietzsche and Dostoevsky, Karl Marx for that matter, to the void. The void cannot complete you. The void cannot give you purpose, the transcendent and the transcendent alone. So the negative characters all throughout Dostoevsky, the novels, are based on the idea that they are suffering and that they are in agony and that they are irrational and that they're acting stupid even when they're not really stupid, primarily because they're seeking purpose in objects that themselves do not have purpose or, at the very least, are not complete. So you got the character who thinks that ideology is going to take care of it. You got the character who thinks that science is going to take care of it. You got the character that thinks that nature is going to take care of it. You even have the characters that believe that dogma and religion and philosophy are going to take care of this. None of this can compare, and none of this can provide solace from this confrontation of the individual soul on the one hand and the void, the ever-changing, always altering flux of the void on the other hand. These things never provide satisfaction. They provide, because they promise satisfaction, they in turn give only suffering when people realize that these promises are broken. And what we're going to have, and we're going to deal with this later, and I think next time, I want to spend the entire period on Prince Mishkin in Dostoevsky's The Idiot. Because salvation is to be found there in a certain Dostoevskian literary sense. What does it mean for the person, for a person, to be in regular contact with the transcendent, with God and with his action? Not necessarily reduced to dogma or doctrine. Although that stuff is important, that's not the final expression. Ultimately, it's a living and devotional communication with the source and cause of all things, that is to say, something that in itself does not change, that is inalterable because it is perfect and whole and true. That ultimately is the end of Dostoevsky's vision, and next time we will deal with Dostoevsky some more in Mishkin in The Idiot, and a few other things concerning those major issues in Russian literature next week. So I want to thank everyone at the Voice of Reason Network. I want to thank, of course, Dietrich and Mishka, who are running the show right now, of everyone who's my producer, everyone who's helping me with this, Mike Connor, of course. I appreciate what you do for me, and it is, I know it's a lot of work, and I want to thank you guys, I want to thank my listeners, and I'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.